An iconic piece of World War II history is coming soon to an airport near you. I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. I got an email today reminding me that the Experimental Aircraft Association's World War II B-17 aluminum overcast is coming soon to the Portland Hillsboro Airport. That's about a half mile from my home. A quick look online revealed it's going to be visiting dozens of airports this year, and it offers one of aviation's most unique and historic experiences. My guest today is George Dobner, Assistant Director of B-17 Operations for the EAA, and he's agreed to spend a few minutes talking about the B-17 in general, the aluminum overcast in particular, and what it's like to be on the tour. George, thanks for taking some time out for our listeners today.
It's our pleasure, Paul.
George, tell me a little bit about the aluminum overcast, how it started out, what its life has been, what it commemorates, and what you guys are doing with it as a program.
Well, basically, it was built right at the end of the war. It did not get over to Europe to get involved, which is one of the reasons why it survived. It didn't get into that little parade of airplanes that came back from Europe back to the storage facilities and then through the chopping machine. So it never got into that process. So it was made or put up for sale, and it was purchased by an organization that used it right after the war for some air freight operations from the Florida area down into Central and South America. It was used over in Asia. It mapped the entire Asian continent. It also was used during a period of time in the 50s for fire ant spraying and control in the southeastern part of the United States. It was eventually purchased by a group of doctors in the late 60s, early 70s, that had an intention of flying the plane around the world, and it was going to be a humanitarian mission, and they were going to, it was a salute to veterans kind of thing, but it was also going to be humanitarian, and of course this all happened in the very early 70s, just when the first oil embargo occurred and the price of fuel skyrocketed, and they came to the realization that they just couldn't afford to fly this plane around the world, so they then decided the best place to put the airplane was with an organization that would utilize it in the proper way, and that was the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh. They gave the plane or donated the plane to EAA with the understanding that we would sit there and eventually put it on tour for the purpose of saluting veterans and for educational purposes. So we started that in 1994. It took us several years to get the airplane back into what we would consider touring condition, because obviously as a sprayer, it had been demilitarized and the inside didn't look like a bomber. But we started in about 1991, 92, restoring the plane and bringing it back to its pure military state. Completed that in the very early spring of 94 and went out on tour. Been doing that ever since. Again, the main objection, wave our flag, the flag of the Experimental Aircraft Association. We are basically the sport aviation organization here in the United States. We promote sport aviation. We promote general aviation. We introduce kids to flying. So that's one of the main goals. The other one is obviously the salute to World War II veterans, you know, as Brokaw put it, the generation that saved the world.
Mm-hmm.
They're going away at a very high rate now. Another 5 to 10 years, they'll be gone. This is our last opportunity to sit there and really salute them. So that it goes hand in hand with, you know, waving our flag, and that's why we're out on the tour. We have approximately 50 to 60 volunteers that are out on the tour, six at a time, traveling around the United States. We do 56 cities a year over a 7.5 to 8 month period. We're on the road continuously, except for two short periods where we come home for major maintenance inspections, basically a 120-hour inspection, similar to an annual inspection on an airplane. We do that twice a year, and of course we bring it home for AirVenture, our air show in Oshkosh, the last week of July.
Right.
Other than that, we're on the road the entire time. We left town on the 26th of March this year, and the director of operations for EAA and myself will be bringing the airplane home on Monday before Thanksgiving. this year. So that's the span of the tour. Quite an undertaking, something that we've been doing, like I said, since 94, and we all just love it.
I have stood on the ramp at the Hillsborough Airport, the Portland Hillsborough Airport here in Oregon, and watched people get on and off the B-17, the aluminum overcast for these flights. And I see a lot of, obviously, World War II veteran-aged guys getting on with family members. And it's obviously has to be a very powerful thing for them to relive this. But I also see some young people way too young to remember World War II, who seem very touched by the opportunity to take this experience.
Well, you have two or three different types of people. Obviously, the veteran who has some tremendous emotional attachment to the airplane, and I cannot tell you the number of stories that have brought me to tears over the course of the time that I've been flying this airplane. I've been on the tour since 96. I got checked out in the airplane in 95 and got my type rating in early 96 and been flying it since. And the stories just absolutely bring you to tears. Some of these guys haven't talked about the airplane until they climb on it and go flying with us, and it's like a switch, and they turn it on, and all of a sudden, all this emotion comes out. There are other people that just, you know, came home from the war, and it didn't have the same effect on them, and they don't have a problem talking about it. So the veterans, you know, there are extremes between the two. Then you have the son, daughter, granddaughter, or whatever, that whose grandfather told them about it, and they never really understood what it was about, and they came out, you know, just, you know, because Grandpa was a pilot on a B-17 or a gunner, and so it's an inquisitive thing for them. And then obviously you have the people that just love aviation, and the B-17 obviously is an icon as far as airplanes are concerned in for this country and for our aviation history, and so they come out just to be close to that iconic aircraft. That's it.
My dad was in the Navy in World War II. He never set foot on a B-17, but I think back on he was sent to the Philippines and almost got there and the war ended. And I still have to think back to the commitment made by millions and millions of people back in that era of our country. And I have to wonder today whether we could summon, if we had to, that same spirit. And I think that for me, seeing the aluminum overcast or any of the other World War II warbirds really brings home to me the commitment that an entire generation made to save this country.
Well, you know, I'll repeat what I said before. There was no question in my mind that Brokaw hit it on the head. It was the generation that saved the world. It was thousands and thousands and thousands of flyers, of ground-pounding infantry. It was the wives and sons and daughters that were left at home that sat there and filled the factories and that gave up their pots and pans and everything else because they needed metal, and they donated it all so it could be turned into a military war machine. So it was the commitment of a generation, and the simple fact is they're going away here, and this is, like we said, this is our last opportunity. So, you know, we want to thank them. And you bring up a very interesting point. Could we rally our country again today to sit there and fight a war like that? And I think we could. If we had a real, genuine war, I believe that we could sit there and we could absolutely rally everybody. I really think the country's, you know, I think the generations are all are all the same. It's just, it's been so long since we've had to do it. Look what we had. We had World War One, mm-hmm. a very short period of time, World War Two, and then Korean War. But we really, you know, and then Vietnam. But even then, we haven't had anything really significant for a period of time. And I think it would happen again if it had to.
I think it would happen again, too. But I have to say that given the tone of the general political discourse these days, it would be an amazing transformation to see if it happened.
Yes, it would. No question about it.
My guest is George Dobner, who is the Assistant Director for B-17 Operations for the Experimental Aircraft Association. We're talking today because the B-17 Flying Fortress Aluminum Overcast is back on tour. And we'll talk more about it in a moment. You're listening to Aero News.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com. Higher, faster, farther, safer. Those are the watchwords of Columbia Aircraft Manufacturing's new generation of personal airplanes. The Columbia 350 and 400 are now available with either an Abadine or Garmin electronic cockpit. The new Garmin G1000 equipped Columbia 350 and 400 have just been introduced with the new ReadyPad. While the G1000 panel integrates all navigation and flight instruments into two high-resolution screens, incorporating GPS, nav, comm, autopilot, transponder, and flight director into one easy-to-use package. To schedule a demo flight in a Columbia 350 or the turbocharged 400, call 541-318-1144 or check them out on the web at flycolumbia.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. I'm Paul Platt, talking today with George Dobner, who is the Assistant Director for B-17 Operations for the Experimental Aircraft Association. And the reason I was prompted to pick up the phone today and talk to George is because the aluminum overcast, which is what EAA calls its B-17, is on tour and will be coming actually to Portland Hillsboro Airport early in June, which will be my chance to catch it. But it's already on tour nationwide and will be in a lot of different places. And, of course, you'll also be able to see it at Oshkosh coming up this summer. George, again, thanks for taking a few minutes out. Let's talk a little bit about the aircraft itself. For the typical light sport aircraft owner, sport pilot, or even people who have been flying J3s or Rocket Champs for years, we're talking about a whole different league when it comes to the care and feeding of a bunch of big radial engines.
I guess the best story I can tell you is a couple of years ago, I was in Lexington, Kentucky, and I was trying to get to Atlanta. The weather had been bad for, the weather had been bad for 3 days. I think we'd been trapped in Lexington. The ceilings were just right on the deck. And, you know, it's an artifact, and we're not interested. I'm going to be able to land safely if I'm going to make a takeoff, okay? I'm not going to have to wonder what's going to be happening. Well, we needed to get Atlanta, and finally the Atlanta ceiling had just come up to minimums, 200 feet and a half mile visibility, and heavy rain, and you know, but there was still the chance that it could go back down. And I had enough fuel to, more than enough fuel for the trip, but it was just so on the edge, I just said, you know, I'm going to throw one more hour's worth of fuel on board. I said, throw 200 more gallons on board. Now, this was 2.5 years ago. They threw 1 hour's worth of fuel on that airplane and handed me a bill for $800. Now, that's a lot of gas. That's a lot of money for 200 gallons for 1 hour of flying. But that really kind of hit me when you look at a fuel bill after you've been at a place for a weekend and you're really not thinking about the number of hours that you flew. But when you sit there and order 1 hour of gas and pay $800, that opens your eyes. Now, today, that same fuel bill on the West Coast would be $1,000.
Oh, yeah.
Because we're paying over $5 a gallon for gas out on the West Coast right now.
Well, let's talk about oil.
Well, we carry our own oil because, first off, it's a unique oil. It's a Phillips multi-weight oil. But, we burn basically a gallon an hour per engine, between a half and a gallon an hour. And so that's, when you sit there and consider 4 gallons, 16 quarts, and you're paying, approximately $5 a quart, that gets a little expensive also.
Well, now, what does it take to keep this tour in the air? Because if I do the quick math, I know that you guys will only fly if you've got 6 takers for a flight.
Yes.
And you can take up to a total of 10 people on board at a time. How do the economics of this all play out? And how in the world does it result in enough money to help keep your other programs going?
Well, for there's two things that you need to understand. The first one is that, we're interested from a flight operations standpoint for the whole year of breaking even. We do, you know, this is an education program for kids. It's a program for adults as well, to our whole flying program, to experience whether it be the World War II bomber, or whether it be the sights and sounds of the early days of air transport, or the early days of aviation period in a biplane from 1929, or a replica of the Spirit of St. Louis. They're all part and parcel of our educational program back in Oshkosh. But to answer your question specifically, we bank on the fact that the average airplane or the average flight is going to have 8.5 to 9 people on board. That the average flight, you know, is going to take off with, or the majority of the time, the plane is going to take off with 10 paying passengers. And it's just once in a while that there's 6 people on board. If we had to do it all the time with 6, we couldn't. It would just absolutely, it would not work. So we fly approximately 4,100 people a year in the airplane. And we do that in approximately 325 hours total time on the airplane.
Okay.
So, you know, that's so you can kind of figure out, you know, how the whole thing washes out. The big variable is what it costs to insure it, because there's only so many of these in the country.
Mm-hmm.
They're very hard to find. And obviously, there's 10 people on board. So the insurance premium to put the plane in the air is huge.
Let me ask you this, because I know some people who would consider coming out to the airport to meet this plane and take a ride would have this question. How safe is this compared to getting on a modern airplane?
Oh, it's extremely safe. Number one, we have people working on this airplane. We spent 3 months of the year, January, February, actually the last part of December, January, February, and the first half of March. We have 4 mechanics that just live that whole period on the airplane, just virtually taking it apart, making sure everything is absolutely perfect, putting it back together. We operate under an FAA exemption because of the type of airplane it is, being a former military airplane, where it's basically much like an airliner or a Part 135 air taxi, on-demand air taxi operator, where the FAA scrutinizes everything we do and every part we put in the plane. So our mechanics are scrutinized, our parts are scrutinized, and our processes, i.e., we do it according to the Boeing maintenance manual. That's what we do. The whole process is just 100% by the book and approved and observed by the FAA. So we're fairly confident that the plane's in as good a shape as any airplane out there.
Well, and frankly, it's in a lot better shape than a lot of them that came home after fights.
Oh, you know, when you see pictures, when you see pictures of some of the B-17s that came home with big holes in them and parts of the wings and the tail gone, and they were still flying. It's really a very stout aircraft. And I do want to say one more thing. The majority of our pilots are retired airline or current airline pilots, and they also are scrutinized yearly check rides by the FAA. So they also are just really top-of-the-line guys.
George, let me ask you something about the B-17's lifespan as a military aircraft, because compared to some more modern aircraft, it was not around that long. It was first put into production in 1937. It was retired right at the end of World War II when the jet age started and it became somewhat obsolete. And so it was only around for about 8 years or 9 years. Yeah, contrast that to the B-52, which they say they're going to keep in the air for 80 years before they retire them, with, you know, constantly upgrading engines and avionics and so forth. Does the B-17 have a distinct draw because of its brief period in history? Does the fact that it wasn't around long make it a more unique draw?
Well, I think there's two things. First off, to expand on what you initially said, if you take a look in 1929, if any of you, any of the people out there are familiar with a Ford Tri-Motor, corrugated aluminum, just a very rudimentary airplane, yet it was a quantum leap from the dope fabric, wood, and steel tube airplanes of the mid-20s. That was 1929. 1935, they designed the B-17, a huge technological leap. Okay, they then, like you said, started producing it in 37. The last ones were produced in 45, and it was a huge technological leap. But at the end of that war, that airplane was absolutely obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
It just was old technology, because they had, in fact, made great strides in engines, basic airplane design. They were moving into the jet age. There was just no place. There was absolutely no place for a B-17. So that's really why the B-17's life was so short-lived. It's because of what was going on in aviation during that period. And obviously, the war enhanced that technological jump, because obviously they were throwing money at that war, and they were throwing money at the war machine, and they were coming up with all these new ideas. So that's why the airplane's length of life was so short. It is absolutely an iconic airplane. It is the airplane that won the war over Europe, so short life or not, it is absolutely has its place in history. It daylight bombing, which was just unique and of itself. You know, the Brits did night bombing because mm-hmm. they thought it was safer, but the U.S. was out there at 30,000 feet day in and day out with the bombers during the daylight, and so. It has its place in history, and I'm telling you, a lot of young American lives were lost fighting that war. So it's in history forever.
Well, you say there was no place for it, but I'm certainly glad that you guys have found a place for at least one B-17. And George, we really appreciate you filling us in on this and giving us some behind the scenes perspective. And good luck on the tour this year. Now, you say you actually fly the plane?
Yes, I'm one of the pilots that flies the plane. Again, I've been flying it since 96. I've been on tour with it since 96.
Well, I'm sure you have not heard your last emotional story from someone taking that ride.
I certainly hope I haven't also. I love every opportunity. If anybody wants to come out, we'll see you there at Hillsborough Airport.
The entire tour schedule is posted, and we'll refer our listeners to www.b17.org, and there's a tour schedule posted there. George, thanks very much, and we appreciate your talking to our listeners today.
Paul, it was absolutely my pleasure. You have a great day.
George Dobner is the Assistant Director for B-17 Operations for the Experimental Aircraft Association, and you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you'll find us at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.